ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Hello, welcome to PM. I'm Samantha Donovan, coming to you from the lands of the Wurundjeri people of the Kulin Nation in Melbourne. Tonight, Israeli tanks roll into Rafah in southern Gaza. The military says it now controls the Palestinian side of the border. Also, the Reserve Bank keeps interest rates on hold. And in Tasmania, the peculiar-looking red handfish saved from the warming ocean.
They've kind of got a face that only a mother can love. They've got an unusual face, but you do fall in love with them when you get to know them. They're just so fascinating.
First this evening, Israel's military has declared it's taken control of the Palestinian side of the Rafah border crossing into Egypt. Tanks have rolled into the city in Gaza's south and gunfights have reportedly broken out. Israel is claiming it has new information that Hamas militants have been operating from the Rafah crossing area. Alison Horne is the ABC's Middle East correspondent. Alison, you've been in a briefing with the Israeli military. What did they say?
Yes, Sam, they've confirmed that the military has now taken control of the Palestinian side of the Rafah border crossing. This is the main crossing point between Gaza and Egypt. It's where the majority of the humanitarian aid has been coming into Gaza during this war, and also a number of Palestinians who've been given permission to leave Gaza. That's where they exit into Rafah. So the fact that Israel now has control of this area is highly significant and signifies that they now have troops on the ground. Not only do they have troops, but they have tanks that are surrounding the area. We've seen videos of parts of the Rafah crossing being bulldozed. We've seen videos of gunfights that they say they're engaging with Hamas militants in that area. We don't know how long this operation is going to last, although the military does say it is a limited operation.
So what's this going to mean, though, for the humanitarian aid people are trying to get to the Palestinians and for those who are trying to leave after that warning yesterday that Palestinians in Rafah should evacuate?
Yeah, it's a good question. I actually put that to the military spokesman when we were in the briefing and they couldn't answer what this meant, whether or not the crossing is currently closed. I mean, they say to me that the operation is still ongoing, so there's still active gunfire in the areas. So I think we can take from that there is no aid that is going through there, but who knows how long that crossing point would be closed for. And if Israel continues to have control of it, what that means for the future of the aid continuing to go through that area, it's really quite unknown. And there would be a lot of people quite distressed about this because, as I said before, this is the main crossing point for aid to not just get into Rafah, but to get into the entirety of Gaza. And you mentioned the evacuations yesterday. It was actually about 24 hours ago that the IDF dropped these flyers into Rafah telling people to leave in the eastern parts. And I think people left pretty quickly. We saw massive streams of people trying to leave Rafah in any way that they could yesterday, particularly those eastern parts. We also saw that aid agencies as well were saying, we're not sure if we're going to leave. The IDF says they believe most of the people have left from those areas that the military signified it would launch an operation into. But I think the speed in which Israel has now launched this ground offensive has shocked some people still.
Yes, it's, as you said, a little more than 24 hours since that warning from Israel yesterday. Was it expected that they'd go in so quickly?
Well, I think it was a little bit of an unknown. In other places where they have dropped flyers before and put out these text message warnings, this kind of speed of an operation happening 12 hours afterwards, after first dropping those flyers. That has not been seen before in this war. And I think that signifies that the Israeli military, in its view at least, believes that there were Hamas militants operating there and they didn't want to give them an opportunity to leave Rafah or to consolidate even further in those areas.
And finally, I understand the Israeli military said they have some new information about Hamas in Rafah. What was that?
So they wouldn't reveal it directly, but they say that it is linked to an incident that happened a few days ago where a barrage of rockets, Hamas rockets, was shot out of Rafah to the Kerem Shalom crossing, which is another crossing on the southern border of Israel. And that barrage of rockets actually targeted a number of soldiers. Four Israeli soldiers were killed. A number more are still in the hospital in a critical condition. And Israel has linked what happened a few days ago with what it says is intelligence that Hamas has been operating out of that Rafah crossing area. But it has gone to lengths to stress that this is, in its words, a targeted and specific ground operation. But I think what everyone is waiting to see now, and the military couldn't answer this, is will this be expanded into a further ground invasion across the entirety of Rafah?
Alison Horn is the ABC's Middle East correspondent. As Israel's military operation begins in Rafah, the chances of a ceasefire are once again looking slim. There were brief hopes a deal could be struck after Hamas announced it had agreed to a proposal brokered by Qatar and Egypt. But Israel says that proposal doesn't meet its requirements. Alison Shaw reports.
In Rafah, in southern Gaza, initial celebrations at news of an apparent ceasefire have faded into disappointment.
I was hoping to reach a truce months ago, before my son was martyred.
Hamas announced it had accepted a proposal from Egyptian and Qatari mediators, which would begin with a six-week ceasefire and the release of 33 Israeli hostages. The second phase would include a complete withdrawal of most Israeli troops from Gaza. But Israel says that deal is a long way from its core demands, and it will press on with its plans to invade Rafah.
It doesn't seem to have met the requirements that the Israelis are looking for. And they have moved in now, and certainly in a limited fashion, around the Rafah crossing area into Egypt.
Dr. David Kilcullen is a former diplomat and soldier and an expert in urban warfare.
The fundamental difference of opinion is that the Israelis want a short-term truce, as it were, whereas Hamas has been pushing for a permanent ceasefire to end the war.
He says Israel seems determined to move forward with this operation to achieve its aims of destroying Hamas.
But I don't think that the foremost consideration for the Israelis right now, certainly the Israeli cabinet, is the recovery of those hostages. Rather, it's to crush Hamas once and for all.
Dr. Marika Sosnowski is an expert on ceasefires at Melbourne Law School. She says negotiations have been going for months, but what each party is willing to accept is constantly changing.
Israel has said that, you know, it wants to destroy Hamas as an organisation. It's unclear to me how a ceasefire of any sort will bring that about. So I'm not clear what it means in terms of its core demands. I think probably where it gets a bit more sticky is probably some of the more aspirational goals. For example, the last clause of the agreement says a complete end to the blockade of the Strip. That's obviously being imposed by Israel on Gaza and has been for a number of years already. Doesn't have any detail in terms of how that will be implemented.
She says Hamas announcing the news it had agreed to the deal was a way to put political pressure on Israel to accept the terms of the agreement or refrain from its attacks on Rafah.
In a way, the release of this agreement to the press by Hamas is a political ploy aimed to sort of pressure Israel into agreeing to a ceasefire, but also in terms of not its military operation in Rafah as well. I think there was possibly a misunderstanding in terms of the headline definitely that I was reading in terms of saying that Hamas had agreed to a ceasefire, it seemed to be implying that there was a ceasefire going to come into force. And that's obviously not the case because Israel hasn't agreed to the terms of that ceasefire yet.
Dr. Marika Sosnowski says a ceasefire could also be dangerous for the civilians living in war-torn Gaza.
If there's a ceasefire, people think the devil is coming, which basically means that when there's a ceasefire agreement or when they're close to one, the bombing and the military operations usually increase quite dramatically in advance of a ceasefire agreement. And I think we see that very much so now, is that Hamas has agreed to this ceasefire, but we still see very intense bombardment, and we see the displacement of, again, thousands of Palestinians from Rafah. Ceasefires are just the least worst options in many cases, and not the panacea I think a lot of people think they might be.
Conflict mediator Oliver McTernan says neither side appears to be acting in good faith.
What we're witnessing, I feel, is not real serious negotiations to end, first and foremost, the conflict, and secondly, to return the hostages where they should be with their families. Since October, there has been a real incompatibility in the stated Israeli aims. It just stands logically. You can't say to someone, look, my intention is to annihilate you, but in the meantime, I want you to give me what you have.
Both Hamas and Israel are due to send delegations to Cairo to discuss next steps.
Alison Chow reporting. Well, for a while there, it looked like Australia's relationship with China was improving, but it's again being tested, with the Prime Minister slamming a confrontation in international waters as unacceptable. An Australian pilot was forced to take evasive action on Saturday after a Chinese military jet detonated flares close to one of our Navy helicopters near South Korea. A top China analyst thinks Australia has little choice but to put up with the harassment to avoid making tensions worse. Gavin Coote has more.
The dangerous interception of an Australian Navy helicopter has only confirmed for some how calculated Beijing is becoming with its actions in international waters. Sam Roggeveen is the director of the International Security Program at the Lowy Institute.
This is absolutely a pattern of behaviour, which indicates that it's not just rogue pilots or rogue commanders at sea who are responsible for this, but that there are instructions coming down from on high.
The Seahawk helicopter was on patrol in the Yellow Sea, enforcing United Nations sanctions on North Korea, when a Chinese jet dropped flares about 300 metres in front of it. It's the latest in a long list of incidents involving Chinese military forces. The Australian government says it's conveyed deep concerns to Beijing, but opposition leader Peter Dutton told Channel 7 he wants the Prime Minister to go further.
I think the Prime Minister should pick the phone up to the Chinese President to express his dismay and really disgust with what has happened, because they have put Australian lives at risk, and that is completely unacceptable.
Prime Minister Anthony Albanese hasn't said whether he's attempted to contact President Xi, who's in France on a state visit.
Dialogue is important. It's always, always important to have avenues of communication. And that's why we've used all of those avenues of communication to make our position on this incident very clear.
Those diplomatic avenues may have been restored thanks to improved relations between Canberra and Beijing, but Sam Roggeveen points out the Chinese military's behaviour has only become more aggressive.
What we've seen since a change of government here in Australia, that the relations have improved markedly with China, and yet that message doesn't seem to be getting through to the Chinese military. So what we can infer from that is that the Chinese military is not getting the same instructions that the Chinese foreign ministry is handing out. The Chinese military is more senior in the hierarchy of that system than is the foreign ministry, and clearly is operating to its own agenda.
Last November, Australian Navy divers were injured after being exposed to sonar pulses from a nearby Chinese warship in the South China Sea. As to how Canberra should respond to this type of behaviour, Sam Roggeveen says ramping up its own military aggression is unthinkable.
One thing to emphasise is that most of these interactions, not all of them, but most of these incidents have happened close to China. And so that is consistent with the fact that the Chinese military is incredibly effective and potent force the nearer you get to its own borders. So when you get into waters near to China, as was the case with this latest incident, then China has a great many formidable capabilities. The further away you get, China's capabilities diminish. So it may be a case of Australia simply, if it chooses to continue operating this far away from Australian territory, from simply having to put up with this, because there is no way, of course, we can respond directly. And so it's something we may have to learn to live with.
Even if that involves that potential for mistakes to happen, many have made the point that, you know, if there is a misjudgment here or a mistake, lives could be at risk.
Absolutely. And not just the lives of those involved in the particular incident, but of course, if there is an accident of the kind you describe, then there is always the potential for escalation where the other side says, well, wait a minute, you did that to us. We now need to do something back to you, and so on and so forth. That is a serious danger. The problem for Australia is that when we're operating this far away from home, that we don't have the capacity to, you know, directly respond. We essentially have to back down. So Australia is in a position where it needs to choose between either putting up with this or backing off.
China's government has blamed Australia for the latest military confrontation. A Chinese Foreign Ministry spokesman says the Australian helicopter came too close to Chinese territory.
Gavin Cooch. This is PM. I'm Samantha Donovan. You can hear all our programs live or later on the ABC Listen app. Ahead, a leading coral scientist accuses the federal government of downplaying the die-off on the Great Barrier Reef. In a small reprieve for those with a home loan, the Reserve Bank has today kept interest rates on hold at 4.35%. In a statement, it said the economic outlook remains uncertain and getting inflation back down to its 2-3% target is unlikely to be smooth. And it singled out the high price of petrol as a big reason for that struggle. David Taylor is our business reporter. David, in all the commentary you read and heard from the Reserve Bank today, did you get any sense of whether it's going to raise interest rates again?
Look, possibly, Sam. Inflation is coming down, but more slowly than the Reserve Bank expected. Now, the RBA still expects inflation to return to its all-important target band of between 2 and 3% by late 2025 and the midpoint by 2026. So that's bang on 2.5%. But Michelle Bullock today, the Reserve Bank governor, said it may be a bumpy ride along the way. In other words, sometimes inflation may seem too hot for everybody's liking, and at other times it may seem it's all okay. Now, the wild card is inflation expectations, or whether or not the general population thinks prices are going to stay high or not. That's critical to the Reserve Bank's thinking. Sam, if people aren't confident that price rises are easing, the Reserve Bank has to counter that by hiking interest rates again. And that stifles demand and hopefully brings those expectations and indeed those prices back down again. Here's the RBA Governor, Michelle Bullock, speaking earlier today.
So at the moment, we still think that we can make our target of coming back into target range by 2025. Really, it's if we saw that inflation expectations were starting to shift and that it was going to take markedly longer to come back into target, then we might have to be thinking about whether or not there needs to be an interest rate rise. But at the moment, that's not our central forecast.
The Reserve Bank Governor, Michelle Bullock. And David, in terms of inflation, what's really worrying the Reserve Bank?
Well, Sam, this idea of so-called sticky inflation, the price rises you keep looking at that just don't seem to budge. So things like the cost of building a new home, rents, electricity prices, and insurance premiums for a whole range of insurance products. Today, though, Michelle Bullock singled out petrol prices.
Myself, I went to fill up my car with petrol the other day and I got an absolute shock when I saw the price of it. Now, that's something that's really obvious to people, but there's an underlying chunk of stuff here which is just eating into people's spending power the whole time. So, yes, it is frustrating, but I think we feel we're on the right path, and I come back to the point earlier that We're trying not to tip the economy into recession.
So Michelle Bullock just mentioned the word recession there. Did she specify what would tip the Australian economy into recession?
Absolutely, Sam. Higher job losses or a higher unemployment rate. And this is where the rubber hits the road. This is really important to understand. If the Reserve Bank increases interest rates, yes, obviously inflation would come back down to its target band quicker and more comfortably as far as the Reserve Bank is concerned. But the trade-off is, of course, much higher unemployment, obviously, because the economy would slow down significantly. People would lose their jobs. The Reserve Bank needs to keep monetary policy at a level that is bringing down inflation at a gradual pace without pushing the economy too far. So, Sam, previously I told you that the Reserve Bank was in a tricky spot. Sam, indeed, it remains that way.
David Taylor, thank you. To the Great Barrier Reef now, and a government authority says progress is being made in assessing the health of the reef's coral and fish as a global coral bleaching event continues. The event was declared by American authorities after widespread coral bleaching in all the world's oceans. And a leading coral scientist is accusing the federal government of downplaying the coral die-off on the reef to protect the Natural Wonders World Heritage listing. Any guest reports.
Even as Terry Hughes studies coral's response to record high water temperatures, he already knows what's needed for these usually spectacular natural wonders.
It really is important to reduce greenhouse gas emissions.
Terry Hughes is a professor of marine biology at James Cook University.
I recently came back from Heron Island, which is in the southern end of the Great Barrier Reef. I've been working at Heron for nearly 40 years. So I have permanent study sites there, which I was able to revisit. So I came back with something like 2,000 photographs, which I've been analysing.
Bleached coral can survive, and while the fifth mass bleaching event in 8 years is still unfolding, some death is already obvious.
It was actually quite shocking to see the extent of loss of corals already at Heron Island. I estimate that between 60 and 80% of the corals have died at various study sites. For some corals, it's very close to 100% loss. The tougher corals, it's much less.
But Mark Reed from the government's Great Barrier Reef Marine Park Authority reports less severe findings so far.
Of the reefs where in-water surveys have been done, the mortality rates that have been recorded has been variable. Some of those reefs have very low mortality. Some of those have got where the mortality has been recorded. It's variable between sort of 15 and 30%.
The level of coral death is relevant to United Nations scientists who are considering whether the reef ought to be listed as in danger. Here's Professor Hughes.
Australia clearly doesn't want to spook UNESCO and the World Heritage Committee. I would expect that closer to half of the corals averaged across the whole Great Barrier Reef will have died in this event.
Mark Reed again.
Once we get this broader analysis done to sort of cover the whole of reef picture, we'll have that more complete picture, and we should have that done within the next month or so.
Along with coral, fish and other marine life may also be affected. Dr. Steph Gardner is on One Tree Island, east of Gladstone, where her University of Sydney research team is seeing fish eating the algae expelled by the sick white coral.
I took it quite personally very hard. I think the first day when we got in, I was in tears most of that day. It just, it made me physically sick, just kind of seeing it and feeling it.
Dr. Gardner's research involves the bacteria in sand, and she's monitoring the impact of the hotter water.
And it's the kind of, the same sort of bacteria we have in our human gut. So it's important for things like metabolism and nutrient cycling and, overall health.
Meanwhile, the coral that survives this mass bleaching event is a focus for Andy Ridley, the CEO of the conservation group Citizens of the Reef.
After this bleaching, we'll be to look for refugia. So these are also reefs that seem, for one reason or another, seem to be surviving the heat to try and look for, in some ways, the lifeboats of coral.
He advocates coral rehabilitation until emissions are cut and water temperatures stabilise.
is basically putting fragments of coral on little metal frames that are interconnected and slowly rebuilding the architecture of a reef, hopefully buy us a bit of time.
A spokesperson for the Federal Environment Minister, Tanya Plibersek, reiterated the government's 43% emissions reduction target and 82% renewable energy target, along with the record $1.2 billion investment in reef resilience. And the Queensland Environment Minister, Leanne Linnard, reiterated her government's 75% emissions reduction target by 2035 and rigorous environmental assessments for coal projects.
Any guest reporting. It's not just Queensland waters that are warming up. In Tasmania, a marine heatwave has prompted a desperate rescue mission to save the very rare red handfish. The peculiar-looking fish uses its hands to sort of walk along the ocean floor. After spending some time in captivity, a few of the species have now been returned to their secret home in waters off Tassie's southeast. Isabel Masali reports.
You may not have heard of the red handfish, but Rochelle Hawkins insists they're pretty popular among those in the know.
A lot of support has been garnered for the beautiful red handfish. When I say beautiful, they've kind of got a face that only a mother can love. They've got an unusual face, but you do fall in love with them when you get to know them. They're just so fascinating.
She's a senior biologist and director of Seahorse World in Tasmania. She's also part of the National Handfish Recovery Team, which has spent the last 10 years protecting the fish. The red handfish is a very strange-looking animal. It's red, as the name suggests, and its fins have what look like little red hands. It seems it's using them to feel its way along the seabed.
And they lack a swim bladder, as all the handfish do, and which means they rest on the floor. And they can swim, but they usually choose just to sit quietly in the one spot unless they're actively feeding. And they have these fins that look a lot like hands, and hence, because they don't swim a lot, they tend to walk on these fins, and they look just very peculiar and very beautiful.
Rochelle Hawkins explains a number of handfish species are critically endangered, but when it comes to the red handfish, there's only an estimated 100 left in the wild, and they can only be found at two secret locations near southeast Tasmania. So, late last year, the forecast of a marine heatwave prompted an emergency meeting. University of Tasmania's marine ecologist, Dr. Jemina Stewart-Smith, says scientists faced a difficult decision.
And so it was consensus from that workshop that the risk of leaving them out there was incredibly high, and so we acted on that risk, I suppose, with all that information.
25 red handfish were removed from the ocean in January and placed in captivity, away from ocean temperatures like this.
This year we saw 38 consecutive days where the temperature reached above 20 degrees, and previously, you know, in the past few years, we've never seen anywhere near that. So I think that the highest prior to that in recent times was 14 days over 20 degrees. So really high temperatures for, sustained periods of time.
A few months later came the moment everyone was waiting for, their release back into the wild. Of the 25 fish, 18 have been returned, 4 have been kept in captivity as an insurance population, and 3 have died. Researchers were hoping for 0 deaths, but they believe that death toll of 3 could have been higher if they didn't act at all.
I think it was this proactive rescue operation that we haven't really seen before in this country, and I don't know that there are too many marine examples worldwide, but there's that increasing pressure on being able to act very quickly in, you know, and particularly in terms of in relation to climate change impacts, which can be unpredictable or occur quite quickly, I suppose.
It's hoped this approach won't be needed again, but the scientists say they've now learnt from this experience, and that gives them an advantage. Dr. Andrew Trotter from the University of Tasmania.
We don't know whether we've, saved any fish from mortality. I guess we'll never know. But we know that, you know, there's a potential that we could have lost a lot of fish with that marine heatwave. So I think it went really well.
And while he acknowledges this won't be the last challenge for the red handfish, he says everyone in the project is determined to ensure the species continues. That includes monitoring the wild population, captive breeding programs, and restoring its habitat.
You know, this is a really unique and beautiful Tasmanian endemic species, and we've lost species in Tasmania before, like the thylacine. It'd be a great shame if we saw the red handfish go the way of the thylacine, and it'd be a great disappointment to all of us to fail in what we're trying to achieve in preserving this species.
Dr. Andrew Trotter from the University of Tasmania. Isabel Massali reporting with Clancy Barlin. Thanks for joining me for PM. I'm Samantha Donovan. If you'd like to listen back to any of our stories, you'll find them on the PM webpage, and you can catch the program live or later on the ABC Listen app. PM will be back at the same time tomorrow. Good night.
Hi, I'm Sam Hawley, host of the ABC News Daily podcast. There have been two knife attacks within just weeks of each other that are being linked to terrorism. Both involved teenage boys. So what's going on? Today, investigative reporter Sean Rubenstein Dunlop on the radicalisation of vulnerable young people. Look for the ABC News Daily podcast on the ABC Listen app.